Hello and welcome to Season 2 of MS Explored, the podcast for people living with MS in Ireland. If you're new to the podcast, MS Explored was developed to provide valuable information about living with and managing MS. In Season 1, we looked at how to navigate the patient journey following diagnosis, the impact living with MS can have on family life, how to navigate work and education, plus the supports and resources available. Season 2 will focus on advancements in the management of MS, how to deal with fatigue, and share first-hand insights into being newly diagnosed with MS and meeting with a neurologist. I'm Aoife Kerwin, and in the first episode of Season 2, I'm delighted to be joined by Andy Walsh from County Mayo, who was diagnosed with MS in 2020, and Dr. Karen O'Connell, consultant neurologist in Tally University Hospital and Piemont Healthcare, and senior clinical lecturer in Trinity College Dublin. In this episode, Andy shares his journey of being first diagnosed with MS and recounts his first experience meeting with a healthcare professional. Dr. O'Connell defines what exactly MS is, offers insight into what a typical consultation with a neurologist might look like, and advises on how to prepare for an appointment. Hi, Andy. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you, Aoife.
Dr. Karen O'Connell, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast too.
Thank you very much. Nice to meet you, Andy, and good to see you again, Aoife.
We have lots of different questions that we want to get through, so I think we could kick off. So, Karen, this episode is for those who might be newly diagnosed with MS or are awaiting a diagnosis and answering some of the most common questions, including what to expect when meeting a neurologist. Can you briefly remind us what exactly MS is?
Yeah, so MS, or multiple sclerosis, is an autoimmune condition that affects the central nervous system, so typically the brain and spinal cord. And the kind of primary pathology is that it damages the fatty covering of nerves, and this can lead to the neurological dysfunction.
And what are the common symptoms that people could look out for?
So I think symptoms with MS are very diverse, and Andy may be able to elaborate a bit more on this later on. But I suppose if we think of people who are maybe first presenting or newly presenting, one of the commonest problems that we see is a thing called optic neuritis. And so this can be either blurring or loss of vision in an eye. It can often be painful. And we see this probably in about a third of people. Other kind of symptoms can vary hugely depending on where in the nervous system is affected. So sometimes we see sensory symptoms. These may typically affect one side of the body or both the legs. We may see weakness. And again, this may typically affect one side of the body. Or we can see slightly more unusual symptoms. We can see things like speech difficulties, memory difficulties. These are less common, but can happen.
And I suppose with some of the symptoms of MS, you know, they can be shared actually with other conditions as well, right? So sometimes when people read the symptoms of MS, they nearly self-diagnose because they experience fatigue and some numbness maybe occasionally and things like that. So I suppose when people experience those kind of things, it's about not jumping to it, right? Because MS shares a symptom set with other conditions.
Yeah, I think that's a really valid point. I think that the symptoms can be very diverse, like you say. I think, you know, if you have any new kind of neurological symptoms, it's not that it may necessarily be MS, but I think it's always worth having a conversation with your doctor about them, and they may warrant further investigation. We see very common things in clinic, like numbness in a hand, and that may be just simply something like a carpal tunnel syndrome, where the little sensory nerve in the wrist is being compressed. Or fatigue, which is, I suppose, very common in lots of conditions, as Aoife said, not even just neurological conditions. So I think my message would be, while the symptoms are very broad and not to jump to conclusions, if you did have some new neurological symptoms, it is always worth having a conversation with your doctor, and they'd be able to explore it a little further with you and decide whether this was something that needed further investigation.
Great, thank you. And could you chat to us a little bit about the different types of MS that there are?
So this is a little bit, I suppose, debated nowadays, and this concept of trying to maybe group MS into different conditions, or whether what we're really seeing is just a spectrum with different degrees of affectedness. is a kind of a bit of a hot topic. But I suppose, broadly speaking, what we do see are kind of patterns of disease onset. So commonly, and the most common type we would see is people presenting perhaps in their younger years, so kind of 20 to 40 years of age, men and women, but much more commonly women than men. And this would be fitting with our more relapsing, remitting type of MS. So this is where someone may have an attack. So like we talked about, maybe something like an optic neuritis, typically will recover from that. And then maybe further down the line may develop new symptoms. There is a less common form of MS that we do see that we call kind of primary progressive MS. And I suppose with this condition, what it is a much more kind of slow, insidious onset. You know, so what has been kind of described to me is, you know, I was very fit and active. I was running 10 kilometres 2 years ago, but then I started to slow down. And, you know, gradually over the last 12 months, I'm walking about a kilometre and I find I'm dragging my legs or they've become very heavy. So rather than that very clear sudden onset of a problem like loss of vision in the eye, they have a much more grumbling or slower course. And that is typically your kind of primary progressive MS. The onset tends to be a little older, so we tend to more see people going into their 40s and 50s. And that sex difference I talked about is not so prominent. So while slightly more common in women than men, it's not quite the same as the earlier onset.
Andy, you were diagnosed with MS in 2020. Being diagnosed with any condition brings with it a certain amount of stress and concern, even confusion. Can you tell us about your journey with MS from when you first started to notice symptoms up to now?
How things started out for me was, I suppose, as I said, towards the end of 2019, just coming to Christmas, I was having a problem where I had a numbness down the left side of my face. And it was unusual because it was exactly the left side of my face. Like even in my lips, it was half my mouth. I also had a problem where my left eye, it would kind of randomly close and it would be twitching. And, you know, that was happening. And I actually took to wearing a baseball cap just to kind of cover that up because it was odd. You know, I couldn't really, I didn't know what it was. I suppose that coupled with I was having sensations when I was in bed at night, I was having kind of like pins and needles across my chest, like the likes of my right leg in my quad, it would randomly kind of cramp up. And all these were little things that weren't all happened together. I was having a problem when I was, well, it wasn't really a problem. It was a sensation when I was driving my car, when I brake, I'd use my right foot to brake. And I felt that the sensation wasn't right. I felt that I was over braking. When I was walking then, my right foot and my right leg kind of just wasn't working right. My foot would be dragging and I knew, just kind of knew that there was something wrong. But I suppose to kind of fast forward, the 11th of March 2020, I went to an osteopath because I had things linked to my own head. I remember saying to her, no, I have no pain. It's just that things don't work. Like my leg doesn't lift and things don't work. She recommended I go for an MRI. But I made a decision kind of there and then, and I rang the Galway clinic. They said to come up the following day, present at ED, and we'll take from there. So I did. I took the next day, I rang in sick to work next day. I went up to the Galway clinic and I had an MRI. And that's, I suppose, that's when the fun starts. I had an MRI. I was out in the waiting room and a doctor came out and he called me in and he said, Mr. Walsh, we need to admit you because something showed up in your scan. So anyway, the long conversation with him, he did mention MS. And he said, look, we have to do more tests. We're going to admit you and we'll know more when we do more tests. I was in the hospital for a few days. The very next day, I had another MRI. I had a lumbar puncture. Yeah, it was as the consultant came along, there was one of the consultants in the hospital, he had said to me, looking at the results of my scans and everything, I remember he said to me, he said, if it sounds like a duck and walks like a duck, chances are it is a duck. So this is what we're going to be dealing with. Like we're dealing with a diagnosis of relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis. So I'm in the hospital. I'm put on a course of steroids. I'm in the hospital for about 4 or 5 days. I come home to a completely different world because COVID has kicked in and everyone's working from home. And, you know, and I'm there. I'm like a spinning top. I'm reeling because there's so much going on. Like COVID is the last thing on my mind and how the country has changed. I've got a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis and I don't know what's actually happening here.
It must have been so surreal for you because I think back to when I was diagnosed and there was no pandemic and it was difficult. So, and, you know, I had family in, so I was in hospital for 3 days after my diagnosis. And just thinking of you not really having that, it was a lot of change at once for you, not just for you personally, but then, you know, the wider world as well. But there's a spectrum of experiences out there with MS. And I just think it's important that, you know, people understand that MS is, it's different for every single person. And can you tell us a little bit about your first meeting with a neurologist?
I'm going to kind of chuckle at this, but the first time that I met my neurologist, so I was actually in the hospital at the time, and so I was put on a 3-day course of steroids. And so the first day that I met my neurologist, he came into me as my second day of physio. I was doing my exercises and stuff, and I'd had a day of steroids done, and he sat down on my bed. And he was going through the notes and stuff. And I was showing him, I was really excited to show him, look, I've actually, my foot can, I can lift it about 3 inches today. Whereas yesterday it was about an inch and a half or 2 inches. Mm. And I was really excited. And he was looking through the notes. And I said to him, I said, my enthusiasm doesn't really seem to be rubbing off on you. And he looked up at me and he goes, that's the effects of the drugs. And I said, but my brain now knows that my foot can now lift. So I said, you know what? I said, that's all I need. I said, that's a positive for me. I'm going to cling to this. And he looked at me and he said, and he kind of nodded and he says, a positive attitude is going to go a long way in fighting this.
Mm.
And that was the first time I met him, you know?
That's brilliant though, because you had a really positive kind of first engagement. And I do think that sometimes kind of sets a course for your relationship with your consultant going forward, right? So you're kind of in a situation where you don't really have much control over this, despite, you know, there are the things that you can do, the positive choices that you can make. But other than that, like, this is your, essentially your partner in this journey, who's going to be seeing you through being established on a treatment, your monitoring, your yearly MRIs, your clinic appointments, all that kind of thing. So I think it's just so positive. And Karen, I might just come to you on that. The first appointment can be overwhelming for people. So is there anything a person can do to help prepare for that first appointment with a neurologist?
Yeah, so I think Andy's probably highlighted some of the themes, but, you know, I think it can be very overwhelming. You're very anxious, you're nervous. I think you've highlighted, Andy, your, you know, only knowledge of MS was that you were ultimately going to end up in a wheelchair. And that is a very common theme and belief when people come through the door. So I think a couple of things I would say. So I think it's always good to have another pair of eyes and ears in the room and to bring someone, I suppose, who you trust or who's important to you. So whether that's your partner, a close friend or a family member. And as Aoife said, it must have been, you know, exceptionally hard the time you were diagnosed, because obviously that wasn't so easy or so possible. I think as well, it's worth just having a little thought before you kind of come through, and maybe like you did, jotting down a couple of questions, you know, because there's a lot of information that's discussed at a first appointment. We're often asking quite a lot of questions of you, you know, and so if there are things you particularly want to ask or you particularly want an answer to, I think it's very important then to have them and kind of highlight them. And as you say, have your list of questions for the end. And I don't think anyone ever minds answering them. I think there's practical things that are helpful. So the first appointment, I suppose, often is where we're trying to piece all the information together. Okay, obviously, people's diagnostic pathways may be slightly different. If people have come through acutely a hospital, maybe some of that will already be in the chart. But if someone's maybe been directly referred in by a GP, we're going to be trying to ask lots of questions about symptoms and previous medical history. So, you know, in advance of the appointment, it's often worth just taking a step back and thinking, you know, is there anything I need to tell the neurologist? Is there anything I don't want to leave out? Practical things around medications. So, you know, if this is something that we're going to be thinking about deciding on a treatment, it's important for us to know what treatments you're on for potential other conditions. Are there any interactions? And I think all those things probably help in terms of getting the most out of the first appointment. What I'll say is, regardless of how prepared you are, you're getting a huge amount of information in one sitting. And, you know, I think what we often do is kind of link in where it is possible. I know not every centre, although most do, with an MS nurse as well. And they often are able to either, you know, do a further appointment in a relatively short period of time. And I think that's really good, because It allows you to go home. It allows you just to have a little bit of a decompress, think about some of those things, and then you know you have a short interval follow-up where you can address maybe some of the things that you feel got past you on the day or you didn't fully grapple with or didn't fully understand. And I'd encourage anyone, you know, if they walk away from an appointment, particularly at the time of diagnosis, and don't feel they're clear on what the plan is, that it's very reasonable to go back and look for more information or to link in with the team again. I think that's a very reasonable thing to do.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people don't think they can do that, you know. So that's great to hear. So Andy, you say that you went in with a list of questions. And Karen, you've mentioned as well that people often come in with a list of questions. What kind of questions are helpful? So what kind of questions should people kind of have ready to ask their neurologist?
So I suppose it'll vary a little bit depending on what that first appointment is. So if the first appointment is you've maybe had a scan with a GP and it's showed some abnormalities and you're coming for an opinion, then that appointment obviously will probably very much centre around needing to do further tests and further diagnostic tests. So as Andy outlined, you know, we'll often repeat imaging, but we'll also do a thing called a lumbar puncture, usually by and large, and further blood tests. So I suppose in that setting, I think some of the questions that you have may be more directed towards a diagnosis, and there may have to be a little bit of an understanding that it's a stepwise process and that the first appointment is about gathering information. But I think the kind of the first questions, maybe when the diagnosis is being made, or kind of reasonable questions that I get asked. So I suppose to make sure you understand what you're being told, you know, what diagnosis you're being given. I think it's reasonable to ask about what treatment options are. I think we're very much of, you know, the approach that these are all shared decisions, you know, and a lot of deciding about treatment will really encompass where someone is in their life. You know, this is a condition that can often affect women, often during childbearing years, that can have some bearing on what choices we make with around treatment. And I think they're kind of reasonable questions to ask, you know, am I going to be on this forever? What treatment would I be on if I wanted to have a baby? What happens to me if I had a baby? Would I get worse? What do I do if I have a relapse? You know, there's lots of very, very reasonable questions to ask. And, you know, that would be where I'd be focusing my questions and just making sure you're understanding the diagnosis.
Thank you. And just to say as well, we actually have a fantastic video on our website with Dr. Karen O'Connell, where she has answered for us some of the most Googled questions about MS. So I would say these are the kind of questions that after you come out of clinic and you begin to think about how you are going to, you know, live your life with MS in terms of travel, family planning, you know, socializing and so on.
Yeah, and I suppose I would just churn out that old adage, but there is no such thing as a stupid question, you know. And I think if something is bothering you and you can get an answer that reassures you and allows you maybe to move on, or you maybe have a misconception because your only experience with MS is due to a relative potentially who had it, you know, it's good to get that and to address that.
Great. And regarding treatments, and you'd mentioned there are kind of questions that people can have about treatments, recognising, of course, that it is very much a case-by-case basis and that no two people are the same. Can you share an example of a typical treatment journey for someone who has been diagnosed with MS?
So I think from when your diagnosis is confirmed, a lot of those factors I mentioned before, you know, in terms of, I suppose, where you are in your life, your age, what other medical conditions you have, particularly for young women around pregnancy, will all come to the fore in terms of deciding treatment. We now have a number of treatments available for MS, and these are available as oral tablets, as injections that you would give yourself at home, or as medications that are administered in hospital. And I think, you know, it'll be a discussion between you and your neurologist which treatment maybe makes would be the right choice for where you're at now, or it makes the most sense for you. In one of the medications, either the oral tablets or the injections you give yourself at home, so the process is reasonably quick and streamlined. Okay, so there are particular bloods that we tend to do before starting certain treatments. These are really around screening for infections that could potentially be made worse by giving these drugs. And so that's a series of blood tests. They're usually back fairly promptly. And we also then would apply for a thing called the long-term illness. So I suppose in some ways we're quite fortunate in Ireland that the cost of medication is covered through this scheme. And that is, a relief for people. So we would apply for that. And people can get started relatively quickly. Okay, there is sometimes a delay, I guess, if there was an abnormality on the screening bloods or there were other investigations that needed to be done. From the point of view of medications been administered in hospital, sometimes there's a little bit of a wait just to get a slot and get an appointment to get those started. I think by and large, in this day and age, most people who are newly diagnosed, you know, we would generally advocate to start therapy. Mm-hmm. And that would be our approach.
Yeah. And I think some people, when they're making a treatment decision, they can think that this is a treatment for life. So how common would it be for people to change treatment after a certain amount of time?
So I suppose all the medications are a little bit different. Our kind of reasons for changing. So if someone is very stable on a medication, I suppose unless there are issues around tolerability, we would generally keep going on that medicine if they are well. In terms of other reasons to change, so I suppose, unfortunately, the first medicine that is used doesn't always work for everybody, and people can get breakthrough activity. So that can sometimes be a reason to prompt a change in medication. Or similarly, if someone is planning pregnancy or someone was to develop another condition or potentially a malignancy, that might also be time where you might review medication and make changes.
Mm. And is it common for people living with MS to feel apprehensive about the idea of needing long-term therapy? And what would you say to those people?
So I suppose from a personal point of view, Andy, and potentially yourself may be in a better position to answer the apprehension, but I would certainly say that I would see it in clinic. And I think it's completely normal. You know, I suppose we're lucky now that we do have a number of treatments that we have reasonably long-term safety data on and can have some reassuring evidence around that. And I think there are a number of countries who have very kind of robust either registries or healthcare databases. And really the evidence over the last number of years has shown that earlier initiation of treatment is associated with better outcomes long term. So we sometimes, you know, think of treatment a little bit like maybe an insurance policy, because it's not that you're going to immediately feel well on these medicines. They're going to immediately change your how you are now. It's sort of about trying to give yourself the best chance going forward to keep you as well as you possibly can be. And I think sometimes when people think about it like that, it makes it, it's more understandable, I guess, and people are more open to the idea of it.
Hmm. Andy, I might just give you the opportunity to come in on this one as well around, I suppose, did you at the time of kind of deciding on treatment and so on, did you have any concerns around it? How did you overcome that?
Yeah, I suppose, and I put myself in the hands of my consultant as to the way I looked at it was, he knows best. And yeah, and I was, you know, I kind of said, well, I'm not going to, like, yes, I can look on Dr. Google, but he's a long while at his game. So I'm not going to come with my suggestion, even while yes, it is important to research and the whole lot. But I felt that he was making the best decision for me, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's great. You know, and it is about, and again, I'll go back to your positive first interaction with them probably helped to reassure you that the decision that was being made for you was appropriate and you know, you trusted in it that bit more. Karen, I might just go back to you and ask about kind of the frequency of appointments and how people are monitored in order to know that their treatment is working for them. So we know from your last response that what the kind of process is for the safety of it. So how do we know when treatments are working?
So I suppose there's a couple of factors to that. So I think most people would be seen in a clinic probably every 6 to 12 months. Okay, just some of that is influenced maybe a little bit on availability, but also maybe what treatment you're on. In terms of trying to assess the effectiveness of the medication, so part of that is obviously that interaction, you know, reviewing how you've been getting on. And we would always perform a neurological examination looking for any signs of MS. And that's kind of done standardly year on year. So we're able to compare to see if we're seeing changes. The second thing that by and large, on most of the active treatments we would do is we would use MRI. So I suppose to this day, really, MRI is still our best surrogate marker of disease activity. So what I mean by that is, outside of someone maybe having a new kind of clinical symptom, it's our best other way of assessing to see if there's underlying disease activity. And generally speaking, we aim to repeat scans at 12 monthly intervals. Sometimes if someone's, you know, very stable for a long time, that could be extended a little bit further. And I think we saw that a bit maybe with COVID, that actually the ratio of breakthrough activity overall, thankfully, is quite low. So they would be the two kind of primary ways that we would monitor people for disease activity. And like I say, the appointments would be about every 6 to 12 months in clinic. But I guess we've all kind of worked hard, and that has been maybe a huge part of that MS nurse role, to try and have a kind of an open door policy if someone is concerned in the interim. So, you know, to offer a degree of flexibility to be able to assess quickly for someone is concerned they're having a relapse or something like that. And so that's where that role also kind of supports people and monitors their disease.
Great, thank you. And with the family and friends, Andy, I suppose a lot of people don't fully understand MS. So did you find it difficult explaining your diagnosis to family and friends?
Yeah, I suppose I don't fully understand MS at times. And again, I suppose that's where I refer to, like, I use a lot of what yourselves do in MS Ireland and the platforms you have, the podcasts, the YouTube videos. I use a lot of that to educate myself. I suppose I've raised a lot of awareness by getting some people involved in fundraising and bits and pieces, and it's helped to educate them.
Mm. Karen, do you have any advice on how to live well with MS?
I think it's a great question as well. I think Andy's probably touched on some of the themes, but I suppose, you know, MS as a condition affects our brain and our brain health. So I think we have to shift our focus then to keeping ourselves as well as possible. And if there are other conditions that could potentially impact our brain, to kind of be proactive in terms of managing them. And I think from a medical point of view, things like keeping an eye on your blood pressure, you know, it's very common. The commonest risk factor for high blood pressure is just getting older, you know, and being proactive in treating it. Similarly with things like screening for diabetes, screening for high cholesterol. So from a medical point of view, they're the kind of more general health and looking after you that I would recommend. I think then, you know, maybe more holistically, I think things like exercise has been shown to have a very positive benefit on disease course. It also has a very positive benefit on mental health, you know, and can be a good way to manage some of the anxiety and stress that, you know, you can experience with conditions like this. I think maintaining social contacts is really important. I think that flexibility that Andy talks about, that way of, you know, not letting the MS stop you doing things, just finding another way of doing it, is really important. It's not an easy thing to do. I think MS Ireland have been really good in this space, you know, in terms of some of the online exercise classes, but also that community element of kind of bringing people together.
Hmm. And again, in a situation where control is kind of a bit of an issue, there are things that people can do and positive things that people can take from it and do for themselves to help change the course of the disease in some way.
Exactly, yeah.
So Karen, what one piece of advice would you give to someone who has just been diagnosed with MS, or maybe someone even awaiting a diagnosis?
I'd like to say that you can be, I feel I can be optimistic around this condition. I think it touches on some of the things we talked about before. You know, we've seen such a dramatic shift in terms of the treatments that have become available over the last number of years. And this is translating into better outcomes for people living with MS. So I suppose my piece of advice would be around this is not the end, you know, that you can be optimistic and that you can go on and live a full, healthy life. And you know, that would be the one thing I suppose I would say to someone now.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much. Well, thank you both very much for joining in the podcast today. We have really covered quite a lot there. And thank you so much for your contributions. I want to thank Andy and Dr. O'Connell for joining us on the first episode of MS Explored, the podcast, Season 2. If you'd like further information on any of the topics discussed today, then please do check out the episode description for links to supports and services. Thank you for listening to MS Explored. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and share.